You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Well, all this week on Peace Watch, we've been playing excerpts of a documentary entitled Beyond War, which takes a look at the real human effects of war, not just on soldiers who choose to fight, but on innocent civilians who often find themselves caught up in the circumstances of violence through forces beyond their own control. In our conclusion to the series today, we take a look at one potentially peaceful solution to military action, the International Criminal Court.
Major funding for this Public Radio International program is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support from the Colomb Foundation, the Compton Foundation, and the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Can you imagine what our national society would look like if we had no clear laws and no courts and no police to enforce it? It would be totally a Wild West. And internationally, we are still, to a large extent, Wild West, but we are certainly moving in a more rational direction.
For the first time, an international criminal court is born. You're listening to Beyond War, a documentary project from Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. Following the heartless, reckless, lawless atrocities committed against civilians in World War II, human rights advocates saw hope in the advent of war crimes trials, where those who witnessed evil told their truth, and where the perpetrators met with punishment. A young American prosecutor at Nuremberg was Benjamin Ferenz.
The Nuremberg tribunals were one important step forward because it said, "We will declare that war-making itself is a crime, the crime against peace, aggressive war, that crimes against humanity, massive criminal acts against the civilian population, are international crimes which will never again be allowed to go unpunished, that major war crimes would be punished. This is an evolution from our civil war practices and rules of war." That was the step forward at Nuremberg, and it was hoped and planned that that would be the beginning of a new codification of international criminal law and the creation of an international criminal court.
This gathering will now come to order.
The United Nations, April 11th, 2002.
Ladies and gentlemen, the legal counsel will now proceed to the dais. He will be followed by the representatives of Bosnia and Herzegovina, Bulgaria, Cambodia, Democratic Republic of the Congo, Ireland.
In all 66 nations, a number that is growing, had deposited their documents ratifying the Rome Statute, a treaty adopted at a UN conference in Rome in 1998, creating the world's first permanent war crimes tribunal, the International Criminal Court.
A page in the history of humankind is being turned.
I think it was a hugely momentous moment. I think it was a milestone in every sense of the word in international law.
Barbara Crosette was UN Bureau Chief for the New York Times.
It was something that most people thought over 50 years who pressed for this just had almost assumed it would never happen or it would take a whole lot longer. So it was a tremendously important moment.
It's incredible to see the labors of all of us come to fruition like this. And this is an institution that is much needed, that the world has waited for very long. And we are very happy that the court is finally coming into existence.
Vahida Nainar from India is active in a coalition of women's legal groups that lobbied for the new court to include sexual violence committed during war in its lengthy, terrible list of punishable crimes. Ending the age of impunity was a watershed moment for UN Secretary General Kofi Annan.
Those who commit crimes, war crimes, genocide, or other crimes against humanity will no longer be beyond the reach of justice. Humanity will be able to defend itself, responding to the worst of human nature with one of the greatest achievements, the rule of law.
Although the United States has not ratified the treaty, the International Criminal Court enjoys broad backing from most of the world's democracies, including England and the entire European Union, Canada, Australia, and many other American allies. Tony Worthington from Scotland is a member of the British Parliament.
We cannot have the Saddam Husseins, the Milosevic's, the Idi Amin's escaping from the consequences of their action. So you have to have an unbiased international criminal court to pick up these issues, to bring justice, and not just to bring justice, but I think when it gets known that you don't get away with these crimes, it will have a preventive effect as well.
In the 1990s, the UN Security Council created tribunals to prosecute war crimes committed in two specific regions where atrocities were rampant, Yugoslavia and Rwanda. They were conceived as temporary tribunals filling a legal gap. The new International Criminal Court, headquartered in The Hague, is designed as the world's first permanent human rights tribunal, and it is intended to be without geographic restriction.
It gives countries diplomatic tools that they otherwise wouldn't have in which to avoid conflict in many cases.
Michael Scharf, author and former legal advisor to the U.S. State Department, heads the War Crimes Research Office at Case Western Reserve University.
When you have a country whose leaders are starting to commit genocide or crimes against humanity or war crimes, instead of having to go in and invade them, instead of having to go in and assassinate them, now you can go and indict them. And once you have an indictment, they become prisoners in their own country. They can't travel abroad. It becomes very hard for a leader to continue to lead under those circumstances.
That certainly happened to Slobodan Milosevic after he was indicted.
It did. It also gives you the moral support for economic sanctions, and sometimes it also gives you the moral support to get an international coalition together to use force. And sometimes force is necessary in order to stop genocide. So ultimately, it may not end war, but it gives us another diplomatic tool by which, in many cases, we can avoid it.
So you think it could help reduce war?
Not just war, but it also can reduce the crimes that governments commit within their own territory. Professor Rudy Rummel from University of Hawaii was nominated for the Nobel Prize for his work called Death by Government, in which he documented meticulously that in the last 50 years, 170 million people have been killed by their own governments. Now, whether that is death during a genocide or crimes against humanity outside of war, or during an internal armed conflict. In either case, this is a situation that just can't stand. And in the past, the international community has looked the other way. Now you've got an international mechanism that is going to focus on that. And it may not be that you get the leaders right away, but as Slobodan Milosevic has shown, if you can indict them and isolate them, ultimately this can lead to their downfall, and ultimately they may face international justice. And the more leaders that face international justice, the more other leaders around the world will say, maybe we have second thoughts about the genocidal campaign that we're launching on. And if they're not going to say that, maybe their followers will say that. But in any case, I do believe that ultimately it will be a deterrent to these kinds of crimes against humanity.
The advent of a lasting international criminal court marks a turning point in the age-old quest to humanize society. The architects of the new court faced an intricate, almost mind-boggling challenge: shaping a valid system of criminal law to encompass the world's worst crimes that could be accepted by enough countries to be workable. The project gained steam and official status in the 1990s, when the collapse of the Soviet Union made possible new relationships among nations. Barbara Crissett covered some of the torturous discussions held at the UN for the New York Times.
They went for months on defining crimes, crimes against women. We learned about ethnic cleansing from things that happened over the last couple of decades, and so there had to be very careful language about the forced movement of people and the changes of residence. And as it was finally codified, they're down into incredible detail. And this is the kind of thing that took so long. Now, lay over top of that, you know, east, west, north, south, and the communist world just coming out from the communist world and having to think in terms of an international system, which they had never taken part in before. This is, of course, what created the hours and hours of discussion and debate, and what made many people almost throw up their hands and say, we're never going to get all these countries together to decide on the common, even the common definitions of a crime.
It seems amazing that they pulled it off.
They did, because they had a lot of committed people, the best legal talent from all over the world, and they had the best legal talent from small, poor countries. They had it from big, powerful countries.
After painstaking deliberation, a consensus was hammered out. There would be three main types of crimes in the court's jurisdiction. War crimes, including use of prohibited weapons and mistreatment of prisoners. Crimes against humanity, in which civilians are systematically harmed. And genocide, which aims to destroy a particular ethnic group. Acts like the 2001 terrorist attack on the World Trade Center would likely be classified as crimes against humanity. Rules for a fair trial were rigorously established, satisfying numerous legal bodies, including the American Bar Association. It was also decided, probably because so many countries have dirty laundry, that only crimes committed after the court came into being could be prosecuted. The clock started on July 1, 2002. Ultimately, governments were asked to sign the International Criminal Court Treaty to finance its judicial operations and, as needed, to provide evidence and to arrest defendants for trial. But also vital to the genesis of the court has been an enormous global network of 2,000 citizen and human rights groups who came together under the Coalition for an International Criminal Court. It is led in New York by a former history professor, William Pace.
Well, historically, international law was the province of representatives of states who were basically meeting in secret and conducting negotiations that would further their national sovereignty interests, their state interests. And it was a scheme in which we were trying to balance power, protect empires, control spheres of influence, etc. This politics failed so disastrously in the 20th century, the worst, most war-ridden century in all of history.
Reacting to the devastation that can result when nations go to war, it was non-governmental organizations like Amnesty International that so often have called attention to crimes and have led the drive to develop new global institutions to enforce universal human rights.
We saw a new ethic of which citizens could kind of be world citizens. They could apply their beliefs beyond their own nation states' borders. And it's gone to the point with the landmines campaign and the process to create the International Criminal Court, where we've created basically a new diplomacy, a new kind of international lawmaking.
But for all its momentum, the vision of a permanent international court has also met with stern, unyielding resistance.
Candor compels that I reiterate this warning. The American people will never accept the claims of the United Nations to be the sole source of legitimacy on the use of force in this world.
In January 2000, Jesse Helms, then powerful chairman of the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee, addressed the United Nations Security Council.
Now, the effort to establish a United Nations International Criminal Court is a case in point. Now, the court's supporters argue that Americans should be willing to sacrifice some of their sovereignty for the noble cause of international justice.
Senator Helms insisted that military might is the surest protector of freedom, and that the U.S. government would not permit an international court to meddle in the activities of the American armed forces. Former New York Times U.N. Bureau Chief Barbara Crosette.
In the last 10, 12 years, 15 years, one of the unfortunate trends has been that the administration has so often allowed the Pentagon, and this is both Democrats and Republicans, to make decisions on international agreements So you start with a Pentagon totally opposed to the idea that any American, anytime, any place could be picked up by an international legal system and put on trial in a court that is not under American control. This is their basic bottom line. They simply do not want to have anything to do with this court, and this current White House has accepted that.
I think much of the debate in the United States, and that would include within the military or within the military departments, which would include the civilian leadership, has not been as comprehensive or fact-based as it might have been.
Retired U.S. Army Major General William Nash observed debate within the American military about the International Criminal Court, but he was unpersuaded that the court posed a threat to U.S. armed forces.
There was great concern, best espoused by some senators, about protecting the American servicemen. Of all the people that I'm not worried about, the American soldier, sailor, airman, and Marines' conduct on the battlefields is at the very top of the list.
Why is that?
Of those that I do not worry about. Number one, they're trained in the laws of war. They go to extraordinary lengths to avoid hitting targets that would have a high probability of collateral damage and loss of life or injury to innocent civilians. I will tell you, as the 1st Armored Division, which I was privileged to command, prepared to go to Bosnia, as one example, my soldiers spent hours and hours and hours putting into our artillery computers all the sites of the religious locations throughout a very large portion of Bosnia-Herzegovina. And so we wanted to make sure that our computers would automatically stop our artillery from firing on places unless there was a conscious military necessity to do so, but that would require human judgment override, and it wouldn't be done in the rush of the moment.
General Nash believes that prevailing Pentagon policies make it very unlikely that U.S. service members would be indicted for war crimes. But the American military establishment remains firmly opposed to any U.S. participation in the International Criminal Court.
We are in a unique position in the world where we have a unique responsibility to help preserve international peace and security.
Pierre Prosper is the Bush administration's ambassador for war crimes issues.
We have service members deployed all over the world in the hundreds of thousands, and we believe that we are in a position where there are people who would like to exploit a process, politicize a process, in order to try to attack the United States, if you will. And it may lead to the possibility of frivolous indictments, frivolous charges.
At some point, you have to recognize that the purpose of this court was not to go after the United States, even though you can spin 100 hypotheticals whereby the United States is charged before this court.
David Sheffer served as chief U.S. government representative at the negotiations to establish the ICC, the International Criminal Court.
The purpose of this court was actually to deal with atrocities of great magnitude that are conspired in by governments, where government leaders actually sit down and plan and conspire genocide. They plan and they conspire a massive assault on a civilian population for the purpose of killing that population, criminal intent, or to ethnically cleanse it. Or they sit down and they actually plan commission of serious war crimes during an armed conflict. Now, the United States government does not do that. If we do, then clearly there should be an investigation under U.S. law of that activity, which the treaty provides for.
The difficulty with the treaty is that while it may give first bite of the apple, if you will, to the domestic court, it still gives final say to the ICC to form an opinion or judge the process that a domestic state undertook.
Bush administration war crimes ambassador Pierre Prosper.
They could form a contrary opinion to what our own courts or juries form here. We could have a case where 12 jurors could listen to the case, form an opinion that there was not enough evidence, or a judge may throw out a particular piece of evidence, the ICC could look at that and basically disagree with what our own citizens decide and say, hey, you know what, we're going to take this case on and we're going to prosecute. So it's a fact that the final say is in the hand of a selected few individuals within the ICC is what poses a problem, and there is no sufficient safeguards or overall check and balance in the procedure.
Under the treaty rules, which have now been ratified by over 89 countries, the International Criminal Court prosecutor could attempt to override the decision of an American court, but only if the American case failed to meet basic standards of a fair trial. That possibility is very unlikely, says former Nuremberg prosecutor Benjamin Ferenz.
There have never been as many controls on any prosecutor, in my knowledge, as this International Criminal Court. There are 89 nations looking over his shoulder at all times. If he were to do anything which were politically motivated, it would be suicide for the court right then and there. He would never get away with it. There are so many different types of controls that I wonder sometimes how he's going to jump all of those hurdles. And to say that the prosecutor has no controls is just not true.
Temporary headquarters of the International Criminal Court is here, at this 17-story modern office building in The Hague. It is under construction, like the court itself. A permanent building for the court is scheduled to open in 2007. The presiding judge, Philippe Kirsch, formerly a Canadian diplomat, believes that a rogue prosecutor is very doubtful under the court's rules.
The prosecutor has to ask a pretrial chamber of three judges whether he can undertake just an investigation. If the pretrial chamber authorizes the prosecutor to do it, then the prosecutor has to notify the states concerned. If the states concerned say, well, no, we are doing our job, we are dealing with this nationally, and this is how, and the prosecutor continues to think that he should still undertake an investigation, he has to go back to the pretrial chamber and get a second authorization. If the second authorization is given and the states concerned continue to contest the legitimacy of the prosecutor's case, then there's an appeals process before an appeals chamber of five judges who have no connection with the pretrial chamber. So tell me, where is the rogue prosecutor there?
Advocates of the new court, including the American Bar Association, insist that such procedures provide ample safeguards against improper indictments. But the Bush administration has not been assuaged. Even though the court treaty was in fact signed by the United States in December 2000 on instruction from President Bill Clinton, Bush officials formally repudiated that signature in a letter to the UN in 2002. It was the first time in the history of the United Nations that any country had repudiated its signature of a treaty, a move that astounded Ambassador David Sheffer, who had executed the signature on behalf of President Clinton.
It represented an abandonment of this process by the United States government in a blatantly in-your-face, almost shocking way. And, you know, there are a lot of treaties that the United States is signatory to and that the administration has absolutely no intention of ever ratifying because they object to certain provisions in those treaties. And yet, with no other treaty did they take this step. This was a blatant, in-your-face, out-of-our-way rejection of a multilateral approach to international justice.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't describe it as an extreme act. What we did is we decided to bring clarity to the U.S. position regarding the International Criminal Court.
Bush Administration Ambassador for War Crimes Issues, Pierre Prosper.
So what we did, what the president decided to do, is to make our intention not to become party to the treaty clear by sending a note to the United Nations as a repository for the Rome Treaty, indicating that we were not going to be sent up for ratification and be a party to it, and therefore did not feel bound by the earlier signature.
And the Bush administration has gone further. former New York Times correspondent Barbara Crosette.
The United States is now running around the world making deals with countries that if you don't ever turn in one of our soldiers, we will never turn in one of yours. Now, this is pernicious for the court because in many of peacekeeping operations where crimes are committed, they are being committed by some of the soldiers from these countries that the United States is now drawing up deals with.
It demonstrates a strenuous effort by the United States to repudiate the rule of law.
Former Nuremberg prosecutor Benjamin Ferenz points to a law passed by the U.S. Congress in 2002 called the American Service Members Protection Act. The act locks in U.S. non-cooperation with the new court and even authorizes military force to free any Americans that might someday be detained by the court in The Hague.
This is an outrageous act which so insulted the Dutch public that they named it the Hague Invasion Act and mocked it and arranged a ceremony by lining up on the beach outside The Hague, barricades, sandbag barricades, and dummy soldiers posted there in case the United States should invade, they would defend Holland from this unjustified assault.
A D-Day invasion in the Netherlands is rated as unlikely by Pierre Prosper, the American war crimes ambassador. But he supports the Bush policy of drawing up agreements to withhold defendants from the International Criminal Court and to cut off U.S. aid to certain countries that don't go along.
But what we're doing is we're not undermining the rule of law. And it is simply saying that if you have one of our nationals and we have one of your nationals, and the person is suspected or wanted for some sort of a international law, humanitarian law violation, you, whatever country we reach an agreement with, will send the person back to the United States rather than sending them to the ICC. And we will take the appropriate actions. We have investigated our people in the past for abuses, and we will continue to do so in the future.
Especially in the eyes of some nations, like England, that ardently believe in the International Criminal Court as a bulwark against war crimes, America's hostility to the court is perceived as arrogant. British Member of Parliament Tony Worthington.
It is saying 4% of the world's population is above the law. That's the action of a bully. We have President Bush saying he wants to take democracy and freedom and the rule of law around the world. But when it applies to Americans in a war situation, he says, not for us. And that lowers the American credibility very seriously indeed.
You're listening to Beyond War, a documentary project from Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. Studio recording by Steve Colby. Editorial assistance from Thomas Royal and Mulberry Studio. Music performed by Brad Hatfield. Our program is presented by Human Media in association with The Network Incorporated. Program development and support provided by Chart Media.
Major funding for this program is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the Colomb Foundation, the Compton Foundation, and from this station and the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Beyond War is produced by David Freudberg and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. If you'd like to purchase a cassette copy of Beyond War by phone, please call toll-free 1-800-5-LISTEN. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons taking the train to Tibet. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.